and will no longer subject it to debate or modification. In this condition, you will not only miss new information, you will overlook important changes in yourself or other people that would negate the fixed belief. One of the most dangerous categories of fixed beliefs is what I call your limiting beliefs. These are beliefs you have about your own shortcomings and limitations, either real or imagined. Let's be clear about what you're hunting for. Beliefs are things you hold to be true and accurate. You treat them as fact. You no longer test them, let alone challenge them, because you believe you have already found the truth. End of story. A limiting belief, then, is some negative self-perception that you have decided is true and accurate about you. You know it is true, so you just accept it and live with it. Some of these limiting beliefs may be rooted as far back as your childhood. You knew that a shrink couldn't talk too long without bringing up your childhood. Other beliefs may be more recent, but all of them contribute to the filter through which you view yourself in the world. Understand how these limiting beliefs affect you. If you enter a competitive situation, whether for a job, a mate, or in quest of some feeling of worthiness, and you're dragging with you a set of beliefs that say you cannot and will not achieve your goal, then you are defeated before you begin. You may recall the old saying, "If you think you can or you think you cannot, you are probably right." It's essential that you identify your limiting beliefs so that when one of them begins to rear its ugly head, you will recognize it and can react against it. Get to know your limiting beliefs so well that if one begins to show even a hint of its presence, alarms will go off and you will counteract it. Maybe you're holding on to beliefs about yourself as being destined for less than a high-quality life. Maybe your limiting beliefs cause you to think of yourself as not being equal to life's challenges. Whatever the message is, such beliefs lead to rigid thinking and rigid behavior, both of which threaten your future and your ability to control it. The time is ripe for reopening these beliefs for confrontation and change. If you fail to address them right now, if you allow yourself to continue being misguided by them, you will compromise your ability to adapt what you're learning in this program to change your life. If you will acknowledge that you've been holding on to certain fixed beliefs that cause you to think and behave in a rigid fashion, you can reopen those subject matters for more active evaluation. In any event, you control your perceptions. Therefore, you control your interpretations of and attitudes about your life. That is power. Life Law Number 7. Life is managed, it is not cured. Your strategy? Learn to take charge of your life and hold on. This is a long ride, and you are the driver every single day. Simply put, never in your life are you without problems and challenges. You know that if everything is calm and peaceful in one area, such as your home, there's likely to be challenge and turmoil in the workplace, or vice versa. We try to dress up this paradox in order to make it okay. Clichés abound about why problems are a good thing. Facing problems builds character. Without occasional pain, we wouldn't be able to recognize and appreciate pleasure. Problems are opportunities to distinguish yourself. While there is probably some truth in each of these clichés, the fact remains that life has to be managed. That's how it is, that's how it has been, and that's how it always will be. If you acknowledge and accept this life law, you are less likely to label every problem as a crisis or to conclude that you're not handling your life successfully. It is important that you come to grips with this law now so you don't make that error in judgment. A long-established fact of psychological functioning is that it is not so much the particular circumstance that upsets the person involved as it is the violation of his or her expectations. If a young, starry-eyed couple enter into marriage with storybook expectations that everything's going to be sweetness and light, they are likely to react very badly to the adjustment pains that typically accompany the merging of two lives into one. On the other hand, if a young couple, perhaps because of other life experiences, anticipate that there will be adjustment pain, if they expect to face problems in the marriage, then the occurrence of these routine challenges will only confirm what they expected, and their emotional reaction will be much, much less problematic. You can help yourself as a life manager if your expectancy set about life is realistic rather than naive. Understand that success is a moving target, and that in an ever-changing world, your life must be actively managed. If, after hearing this audiobook, you implement all of the teachings, truths, and principles that you care to accept, your life will very likely be in a great place, and of course I will be delighted for you. But know that how well your life is working 5 years from now will be a function of how well you are actively managing yourself from now until then. You've probably noticed that I've referred to you as a life manager, as though you were two distinct people, one of whom had a client to manage. It will be highly valuable for you, from this point forward, to think about yourself as the manager of your life in the same way you might think of and evaluate the manager of a store or a supervisor in your workplace. Thinking about the manager of your life as if he or she were another person can give you some needed objectivity in stepping back and assessing how you're doing. If you think about the state of your life as a function of how well your life manager is doing, you'll have an objective yardstick for measuring your efficiency. Suppose you were called upon today to give your life manager a performance evaluation. How would you rate that manager's performance? As the evaluator, you might decide that your biggest problem is that you can't fire your life manager the same way you might fire someone who was mismanaging your business or your employees. This is a life manager you have to work with, motivate, educate, and be patient with. Make no mistake, you are a life manager, and your objective is to manage your life in a way that generates high-quality results. If you're not doing a very good job, then you need to wake up and get on the ball. You may not be the only client you have, particularly if your family includes children or people who act like children. But you are your most important client. As your own client, you must treat yourself with great care and manage yourself with the understanding that you are a very important person. In fact, I can tell you that the most important person in my life is Phil McGraw. I do not apologize for that, nor do I believe that it is selfish. I am the only husband and father that my wife and children have. If I take care of myself, then I have something to give in those two important roles. If I choose instead to be a martyr, if I constantly self-sacrifice and do not take care of myself, then I may not be there physically or emotionally when they need me. If I do not make deposits to the Phil account along the way, I may find myself emotionally and physically bankrupt at some point in the future when the people I love are most in need of me. My motive for taking care of myself is admittedly them. But I am not just playing word games. This belief affects how I treat myself day to day. To keep from cheating them, I must take care of myself. You are your number one worldly resource. Manage it and manage it well. If you are going to start to require more of yourself as a life manager, step up and do it like you mean it. Work as hard as you would expect anyone you might hire for the job to work. If you were paying big money to a life manager, you would want that person to absolutely get after the job. It's time now to start managing your life with that kind of purpose. Managing your life with design and commitment will cause what you do to look, feel, and be different. You'll know you have a life with energy, a life that matters, because you treat your life that way. Think about someone taking a leisurely stroll through the park on a sunny day. He's got no particular place to go and no particular time in which to do it. He walks slowly, meandering, hands in his pockets, turning this way and that. He pauses frequently and may turn randomly, occasionally doubling back or staring into space. Now, if the point is simply to enjoy the sunshine and the scenery, there's nothing wrong with this kind of attitude and approach. We do need on occasion to have this kind of experience. But it is no model for a life manager with big change and big challenge as the order of the day. Contrast such behavior with that of someone who is on point, determined to make it to an important meeting, perhaps. He's cutting through the park to save time. He walks with purpose, direction, and perhaps even urgency. There's a spring in his step. He's got a place to go, he has a limited time in which to get there, and he will not be distracted from his goal. Even the most casual observer could pick which of these two people was on a mission. You will soon be putting together a highly personal, individualized strategy that will enable you to manage your life by design, rather than as if it were a meandering stroll through the park. You must approach this task with the most intense commitment, direction, and urgency you can muster. Your mission is to stop the momentum and direction you now have and replace them with the momentum and direction you want. If you approach this mission with nothing more than a heightened awareness, you will never get what you want. To change your life, you must be different. Really managing your life means that you will stop living reactively and put your life on project status. Project status means that the matter at hand has taken on a special significance and a special urgency, lifting it above your other concerns. Think about painting your house, for example. If you just kind of decided, it would be nice if this house got painted someday. How soon and how efficiently do you think it would get painted? Compare this attitude to waking up one Saturday morning at 7 a.m. and declaring, "Project status, I'm going to paint this house and I'm going to do it by midnight Sunday." The difference in your rate of progress would be astounding. That's the difference between how you are now living and how you will be living if you start designing your life as if you meant it. Project status means that you will approach your life with the conviction that you deserve what others have and that you're worth the effort required to get it. Remember, the primary difference between you and those lucky people is simply this. They did what they did, and you did what you did. You just settled too early and too cheaply. The rest of this year will go by whether you are doing something to improve your life or not. Don't start on this project tomorrow or even later today. Start now. If you've made it this far into this audiobook, you are serious about having something different in your life. Put your life on project status, and you will have what you want. It should be clear to you why this issue of self-requirement rises to the level of a life decision. Resolving that you will not be a passenger in life and that you will require excellence from yourself in all areas is a defining moment in your life. Unfortunately, you may not have thought to conduct this heart-to-heart conversation with yourself before now. But there can be no better time than right now for deciding, as a matter of principle, what you will demand from yourself as contrasted with what you're willing to accept from yourself. This standard you adopt should be one that you do not have to recreate every day. For that reason, this is a matter of great concern and relevance, worthy of the most careful and attentive self-conversation. In thinking about your self-requirement, you may discover that you're living in a comfort zone. You're avoiding reaching for a level of achievement or accomplishment that is not already comfortable. You are complacently going through the motions of your life because you have adapted to that level of demand. You are living a risk-aversive life. While comfortable, that sort of life can be more than stagnant. Staying in your comfort zone can be hazardous to your genuine well-being. Step out of your comfort zone. Behave differently by resolving to work harder and work smarter. That means demanding more of yourself in every area across the board. If you are honest, I wager you will admit that you are life lazy. For example, I'll bet you never take the mental and emotional energy to sit down and write out a goal and a plan to get that goal. You may intend to, but I'll bet you let yourself slide. Effective life management means that you ramp up. You've simply got to require more of yourself in every category of behavior, even the mundane. Your grooming, self-control, emotional management, interaction with others, your work performance, your dealing with fear, and in every other category you can think of. Starting now, begin each and every day of your life with a question. What can I do today to make my life better? Ask it, answer it, and then do it every single day. Maybe you've wanted for years to get in shape, but every day you come home tired and crawl onto your couch like a lizard on a rock and just sit there. Don't do that. Beginning today, don't do that. As someone who exercises virtually every day, I can tell you that at least a third of the time, I'm sure I'm too tired, too exhausted to exercise. But 15 minutes into my workout, I am feeling better. I'm energized, and I have a better frame of mind and outlook on what lies ahead. Don't give in to your negative momentum. Require more of yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, and behaviorally. For example, if you are in a relationship where you invariably lose your temper and get into an argument or shouting match, resolve to require more of yourself. The next time there's a conflict brewing, resolve either to walk away or to respond in a calmer fashion. Stop going with the flow in your life. Start your own river instead. The essence of this life law is that you are your own most important resource for making your life work. How well you handle your overall life will be a direct reflection of how well you're managing your personal life. Although it may sound politically incorrect, my strongly held belief is that you do have to make you the most important person in your life. People are quick to react to that advice in knee-jerk fashion, as though it were encouraging behavior that is selfish and asocial. I submit to you that it is anything but. I'm sure you are aware of times in your life when you made a decision and it just clicked. Everything worked. It felt right at the time, it worked subsequently, and it only looked more right with the passage of time. But since life is imperfect, not every decision that you make or have made will naturally be a winner. Here's an important rule to fold into your philosophy of life management. Sometimes you make the right decision, and sometimes you have to make the decision right. Poor choices are the ones that test your maturity and resolve. These are the ones about which you have to say, I will make this decision right. Meaning I will work to resolve the flaws. I will work to find a solution, and I will be committed to the end. I'm talking here about maturity. It is so easy, particularly early in life, to bail out on those things that don't work at first blush. But decisions such as marriage and children are not so easy to undo. Resolve that in your life you will make a concerted effort to make right the wrong decisions you have made. Life law number 8. We teach people how to treat us. Your strategy? Own rather than complain about how people treat you. Learn to renegotiate your relationships to have what you want. The life laws you have learned thus far have focused on how and why you get the results that you do as you go through your life. This law is no exception. It deals specifically with how you define your relationships and how you get results. But it has an important added dimension. This law takes into account the fact that in addition to getting results, you yourself are a result, and therefore you shape the behavior of those with whom you interact. Because people learn by results, whether or not you reward, accept, or validate their behavior impacts their subsequent conduct and will influence their choices. How you interpret and react to their behavior determines whether or not they are likely to repeat it. You therefore actively participate in defining your relationships. If the people in your life treat you in an undesirable way, you're going to want to figure out what you're doing to reinforce, elicit, or allow that treatment. If you're involved in a relationship in which someone is consistently abusive, exploitive, or insensitive towards you, find out what you're doing to encourage that behavior so that you can realign the relationship in a more healthy direction. Relationships are mutually defined. Each participant contributes importantly to its definition. From the very outset, it is a give-and-take negotiation between the participants. Together, you and your partner hammer out the terms, rules, and guidelines. Therefore, if you don't like the deal, don't blame just your partner. You have ownership of that relationship just as much as he or she does. I once counseled a middle-aged couple who had been married 27 years. John was an electrical contractor and Kay was a highly experienced medical receptionist. Both came from large families and had raised 4 children themselves, all grown and out on their own. While they professed to love each other very much, they acknowledged they had come to me because their communication was terrible. They arrived at my office one day right after a holiday, saying that they had recently had their worst fight in all their years together. Kay fumed but said nothing as John described the events leading up to the fight. He said that he had developed an annual tradition of staying up all night on Thanksgiving Eve to cook the turkey for the large family gathering that was always held at their home. On this particular Thanksgiving, they were expecting 26 family members for dinner. While he only occasionally drank alcohol, John said that his traditional Thanksgiving ritual was as follows. Every Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, I get a jug of Jack Daniels and wait until she and any of the company turn in, and then I start cooking. I like to cook it real slow, so usually about midnight, I stick the bird in the oven, knock the top off the jug of whiskey, and start an all-night ordeal. Usually after a quart of Jack Daniels, me and that turkey get done about the same time. Over the years, Kay had not seemed to mind this ritual. Unfortunately, however, this particular year, John apparently got a little ahead of the turkey with regard to the whiskey drinking and forgot to light the oven. By the time he discovered the problem, it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and he had a 28-pound turkey still refrigerator cold. With reasoning that could only spring from a mind pickled in Jack Daniels, he made the only logical decision, fry the turkey, piece by piece. When Kay entered the kitchen the next morning and found grease stains decorating every wall, turkey parts being fried in 8 or 9 different skillets and pans, and John up to his eyebrows in flour, she was decidedly unhappy. And as the old saying goes, when Mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. This crisis had strained John and Kay beyond all reason. For 10 days they had essentially not spoken. Each blamed the other for the disastrous state of their relationship. In John's view, the reason they didn't have much of a marriage was that Kay almost never spoke. Kay insisted that they had a poor relationship because John was always running off at the mouth and would never listen. Like most couples, they had not really come to me for help, but instead to have a referee or a judge who could declare which of them was right and which was wrong. Not surprisingly, I couldn't fulfill that request because neither John nor Kay was right or wrong. They had mutually defined their relationship. John had taught Kay that it was acceptable to treat him passively, with little or no communication, because for years and years he had accepted that behavior. Kay had taught John that he could dominate the relationship and do all the talking because she had allowed him to do so for 27 years. By letting each other get away with problem behavior, each had taught the other that his or her behavior was acceptable. When they finally reached the point in their lives when only the two of them were left at home, and there were no children to act as buffers, their problems came to the forefront. At last, in the face of what they considered to be a major crisis, the Thanksgiving debacle, the foundation of their mutually defined relationship began to crack. It was time for them to recognize that each had taught the other how to treat him or her, and that in neither case was that treatment healthy. Once John and Kay stopped reinforcing each other's unacceptable behavior, they began to develop better communication skills and a greater degree of intimacy and trust, although I don't believe John ever got solo turkey duty again. As John and Kay's history demonstrates, even a pattern of relating that is almost 30 years old can be redefined. If you can teach people how to treat you in the first place, you can reteach them how to treat you after that. It is in the give and take of relating and of results that relationships are successfully negotiated. You may not have known that you were negotiating and creating, but you were. Now you know. Being in a meaningful negotiation and not knowing it can be very dangerous. The good news is that because you are accountable, you can declare the relationship reopened for negotiation at any time you choose and for as long as you choose. John and Kay did exactly that after almost 30 years. In any case, new relationships or old, you are responsible for whatever state your relationships are in. Please understand that I mean that you are responsible in the most literal sense, and even in the most extreme, seemingly one-sided circumstances. In a much more serious and tragic example of this law, I recall once early in my career being summoned to the emergency room of a local hospital by a neurosurgeon with whom I had worked on a daily basis. Because I had developed a practice which included the diagnosis and treatment of brain trauma and disorders, he had asked me to help him develop a functional diagnosis of a woman with possible acute trauma to the brain and spinal cord and a possible closed head injury. I was only a few blocks from the hospital when I got the page, so I arrived even before the attendants had finished cleaning up the patient and taking her history. Dolores was semi-conscious when I entered the room, but was anything but talkative. Her scalp had been lacerated at the hairline, and the flesh was laid back 4 to 5 inches across almost the entire width of her forehead. Her left ear dangled and would have to be surgically reattached. Her bottom teeth protruded through her lower lip and chin, and her nose was severely broken, displaced, and lacerated. This hospital was located not far from a major interstate highway where serious accidents had become commonplace. Dolores's injuries were consistent with having gone through the windshield of a car. It appeared she might even have hit the pavement. More to determine her degree of orientation than to actually gather details, I began to ask her questions. My first question was, Dolores, tell me where this happened. It would be of diagnostic significance, not to mention legal significance, whether or not she had amnesia and whether she could report accurately as to person, place, and time. I also wanted to test her short-term memory by finding out if she could identify the highway or the intersection for me. To say that Dolores' answer stunned me would be a huge understatement. In a soft, slurred voice, she answered, "It happened in my den and bedroom." She went on to reluctantly confess that her husband had beaten her. I was bewildered, I was appalled, and I was angry. All of the grotesque injuries I saw were the work of her life partner? In an effort to comfort her, I said, "I am so terribly sorry that this has happened to you. You must just be shocked." Looking back at me through blood-stained and swollen eyes, Dolores sort of shrugged her shoulders. Then she said, "Well, I was shocked the first time, but I guess I'm not anymore." I confess to you that my attitude immediately changed. I was no less horrified by the scope and intensity of her suffering, and I was deeply convinced that her husband was vicious, wicked, and sick. But now I was confused. How could these people live like this? In my way of thinking, this was attempted murder. I instantly thought, "Dolores, whatever the deal, whatever his hold on you, you must escape. This is not okay." Reviewing her chart, I learned the sad history of her previous trips to the emergency room. Her husband had broken 4 of her ribs. He had held her hands down on a hot kitchen burner. He had knocked her unconscious 2, and over the last 3 years she had needed stitches several times. Always she covered for him. Each time she lied, and ultimately she went home to him. While there's no question that this was an extremely sad situation, I maintain that Dolores' accountability in this relationship was undeniable. By remaining with him and failing to press charges against him, she had effectively and consistently taught him that this is okay. You can get away with this. I will let you beat on me and even kill me. Now you may say, "Dr. McGraw, you don't understand. It's hard for the woman in this situation, particularly if she's not employed outside the home, to have the wherewithal to escape." I know that is true, and that it is a helpless feeling to be trapped and have no ready option. It is difficult, particularly if leaving puts children in jeopardy. But even so, you must first and foremost protect your life and body. You either teach people to treat you with dignity and respect, or you don't. If you remain in a sick situation, then they get away with it, and you are worth far more than that. Dolores was not to blame. Dolores was the victim of a terrible crime, but she and only she could remove him or herself from the danger. In my opinion, her husband was too sick to trust, ever. She had to rely on herself. There is no in-between, there is no mitigation, there is no excuse, and there is no alternative. If you are getting beat on, you had better get out, reach for help, and reach now. Our hospital system provided little help. My colleague and I did call the police. Ultimately, Dolores' husband received probation. But when I last heard about them, they were back together. Whoever your relationship partner or partners may be, you have taught them the rules and you have taught them the boundaries for those relationships. They have learned your response patterns and incorporated them into their actions. If you acknowledge your role in this ongoing transaction, then you are living and thinking in accordance with Life Law 2, being accountable. you are acknowledging that you have created your own experience and that when you choose to accept certain conduct from your partner, you choose the consequence of living with that conduct. You are acknowledging that if your partner is doing certain things with, for, or to you, he or she is doing them because the two of you have worked it out that way. Your partner will have to be retrained about what works and what doesn't. I fervently hope that you're not in a relationship that's abusive or sick like Dolores's. But the rules are the same. You teach people what they can get away with and what they cannot. You teach them by either actively rewarding their destructive relationship behavior or by passively allowing them to persist in that behavior. If and when you acknowledge this life law, you will begin to analyze your relationship behavior. You will not ask why your relationship is where it is, but why not? You will see that it is where it is because you programmed it that way. If you are the one who determines whether or not the things people do are working for you or not, then you can change the relationship, starting right now. I'm not saying it will be easy. You have to decide if you're worth the trouble. The fundamental issue, of course, is whether or not you are paying off your partner for unwanted behavior. I'm not suggesting that payoff should not be part of a relationship. If your partner treats you with dignity and respect, then it's only appropriate that you pay him or her off for that desirable behavior. On the other hand, if your partner treats you with insensitivity or cruelty, and you are paying him or her off for it, then that needs to stop. When people are aggressive, bossy, or controlling, and it works, meaning they get their way, you have rewarded them for unacceptable behavior. Your challenge, then, is to identify what payoffs you may be giving your partner in response to any negative behavior. This sort of pattern should be easy enough to spot. For example, if your partner pouts when you don't comply and you give in, bingo, payoff for pouting. They now know how to treat you to get their way. But it may be that the payoffs you most need to identify are much less apparent. Sometimes we cheat ourselves by not requiring our partners to pull their own weight, thus allowing them to get by with lazy performance or poor quality performance. Specific payoff? They get to coast. Perhaps you are constantly covering for your partner's inadequacies or shouldering a mental, emotional, or financial load that is way more than reasonable. Specific payoff? He or she enjoys the fruits of your labor. Even more insidiously, perhaps you're holding yourself back in your level of performance so as not to threaten your partner. Specific payoff? A false sense of equality and security. Before you reopen the negotiation, you must commit to do so from a position of strength and power, not fear and self-doubt. Getting to that position requires the knowledge and the resolve we have discussed. The knowledge you have been accumulating since you began listening to me must be uncompromising. You must make a life decision that you would rather be well by yourself than sick with somebody else. This means that you're not playing a game, you are not bluffing, and you are not taking positions for shock value. It means that you would rather be by yourself, treating yourself with dignity and respect, and living healthily and happily than be with a partner you cannot trust. You may be dependent on this person, and you may have a habit of being with him or her, but if he or she is not willing to treat you reasonably and properly, you must be willing to say, "Change your way, or I am out of here." You don't want to mess around here, because the worst thing you could do is make a lot of noise about changing things only to revert back to the old familiar destructive patterns. To talk about change and not do it is to teach your partner to treat your statements and declarations lightly. You will teach him or her to be patient, confident that you will soon give in. Your commitment to change needs to rise to the level of the life decisions we discussed earlier. Where your relationship standards are concerned, commit to yourself that although it may be difficult to affect change, you will not compromise. To compromise in this area is to sell out your most precious commodity, you. By requiring more from yourself and your partner, you are in essence changing the deal. And make no mistake, those with whom you are currently in relationships won't like it. They will resist your changing the status quo. You taught them the rules, you've been rewarding their conduct, and they, like you, have gotten comfortable with the deal. If the price of poker is about to go up, it's only fair that you warn them about the changes before you begin to respond to their behavior in a different way. If you have taught someone to go on green and stop on red, but now change the rules, he or she is entitled to know about the change. When I say your partner will resist, do not underestimate the vigor of that resistance. The resistance may range from allegations that you just don't care anymore, all the way to emotional extortion. Emotional extortion may take the form of threats to leave if you don't cave in on your new position, or may even involve agitated threats of suicide. In any event, the primary thrust of the attack will be based on guilt. Guilt is a powerful and destructive weapon in relationships, and you must steel yourself against being manipulated by it. Guilt paralyzes you and shuts you down. No progress is made if you are whipping yourself with shame. The healthy alternative is to acknowledge any problem behavior, figure out why the problem behavior happens, and make a plan for change. Life rewards action. Guilt is paralysis. Stay the course. Do not be diverted from your resolve. If your partner threatens to leave or commit suicide, that's a bluff you must call. If you think the threat to harm him or herself is genuine, your relationship and your partner were much more unstable than you thought. In any event, if you believe they are capable of hurting themselves, call the police or the county sheriff and let the professionals deal with it, but do not cave in. If you back off, you are teaching your partner that you can be handled. Finally, and in the interest of fairness and completeness, no discussion of life law number 8 would be complete without your considering it from the outside looking in. What are the people in your life letting you get away with? Have they taught you that it is okay for you to treat them with less than dignity and respect? Have they taught you that you can coast in your relationships, functioning at less than a quality level? Remember the principle of reciprocity. You get what you give. Don't ask people to do what you're not willing to do yourself. Take a focused and serious look at your behavior in relationships. What payoffs are you getting for unhealthy conduct? Are you willing not just to identify those payoffs, but to give them up? By being honest about your own behavior, you can win tremendous credibility and foster an environment conducive to change. Don't ever take someone else's inventory if you're not willing to take your own. Life law number 9. There is power in forgiveness. Your strategy? Open your eyes to what anger and resentment are doing to you. Take your power back from those who have hurt you. Of all of the emotions in the human repertoire, hate, anger, and resentment are among the most powerful and self-destructive. They are awakened in you by the actions of those you perceive to have hurt you or those you love. You may think that you want and are justified to hate or harbor rage against someone who has hurt you deeply enough to create these emotions. You may believe that they deserve it and are made to suffer by your hatred of them. You may sometimes treat your hatred as though it was a mythical curse on the target of your disdain. But to do so, to carry and feel that hatred, is to pay an unbelievably high price. For the reality is that those feelings change who you are. They change your heart and your mind. Like fire raging through a dry forest, these intense emotions can become so pervasive as to crowd every other feeling out of your heart, consuming you with behavior that is either external vicious aggression or internal deep bitterness. Think about it. When you encounter someone who is in the grip of these emotions and see the outward expression of their inner turmoil, it takes little imagination to guess what that person must be going through inside. Hatred, anger, and resentment eat away at the heart and soul of the person who carries them. I mean this in its most literal sense. When you harbor hatred, anger, and resentment, your body's chemical balance is dramatically disrupted. Your fight-or-flight responses stay aroused 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That means that hatred, anger, and resentment are absolutely incompatible with peace, joy, and relaxation. If you're carrying around these ugly emotions, it's likely that your body is almost constantly in a condition called heterostasis, a condition of physiological imbalance. Put simply, it's a state of having too much of this in terms of your natural chemistry and not enough of that. People who stay in this powerfully aroused state often experience sleep disturbance, nightmares, poor concentration, and fatigue. It's not uncommon for them to develop tension headaches, migraine headaches, ulcers, back spasms, and even heart attacks. People are not built to be happy and sad at the same time. It is impossible for us to feel simultaneously peaceful and agitated. So to the extent that these powerful emotions crowd their more positive counterparts out of your experience, your physical state is going to be miserable. I have told you what the effects of these emotions are on your body. You also need to recognize that these feelings are the stuff of which emotional prisons are made. When you choose to bear hate, anger, or resentment towards others, you build walls around yourself. You become trapped in an emotional complex of such pain and agony that negative energy begins to dominate your entire life. And, in addition to imprisoning you, these emotions have a spillover effect. They do not remain specific to the relationship in which you were damaged. Recall that you bring your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs into every relationship you have. To assume that you can turn your feelings on and off like a light switch is naive. I suspect you already know that it doesn't work that way. Bitterness and anger are such powerful influences that once they enter your heart, they are present in all of your relationships. They truly do make you become a different person. Who you were goes away, and now you are defined by the hatred and bitterness. Ultimately, what makes these emotions so powerful is that they change who you are. They change what you do and contaminate what you have to give. Think about that. It means that those who love you don't get you. They get the bitter shell of who you once were. Smoldering anger or bitterness completely disfigures your perceptions and therefore the manner in which you engage, receive, and filter the world. There is no reality, only perception, and yours is altered by these ugly emotions. Don't assume that they can be concealed behind a mask. The stimulus you provide, namely the face you wear, is unmistakably one of bitterness, rage, or withdrawal. You give people in turn little choice in how they react to you. If you're dragging the chains of hatred, anger, and resentment into your relationships, you are contaminating them. Clearly, you are eroding the quality of your emotional and relational life. Your task is to undo those chains so that you do not take those emotions with you into these other relationships. For the sake of your spouse, your children, other loved ones, and yourself, you must have the courage to break these bonds and cleanse your heart and mind of the poison of hatred. You must learn that you do not have to be angry just because you have the right to be angry. If you still insist on being right with respect to your own anger, there's something else you must consider. You cannot give away what you do not have. Think about that in its most literal sense. No matter how much you might like to, you can't give someone $1 million if you don't have it. Similarly, you cannot give pure and accepting love from a pure and accepting heart if you have neither. Recall that the second life law, you create your own experience, expressed the reality that when you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. You've got to apply this truth to whatever anger and bitterness you may be carrying right now. Recognize that you are the one who chooses the behavior, thereby creating the consequences. Further, remember, a thought is a behavior, and it must be treated the same as any other behavior. To this principle, add life law number 6. You know and experience this world only through the perceptions that you create. Your perceptions consist of your interpretations of the world. These two laws work in powerful combination to determine the quality of your emotional life. You and only you choose how you feel. Others can provide an event or behavior for you to react to, but it is up to you to choose how you feel about them. If you choose to carry the hatred, then know that you choose to see the world through a dark filter that in turn dictates a dark perception of the world. Ultimately, and this may be extremely difficult for you to accept, forgiveness of those who have transgressed against you or those you love is not about them, it is about you. Forgiveness is about doing whatever it takes to preserve the power to create your own emotional state. It's about being able to say, "You cannot hurt me," and then control me, even in your absence, by turning my heart cold and changing who I am and what I value. I am the one who makes those choices. You cannot choose for me how I feel, and I will not give you that power. Most importantly, you must be willing to say, from your heart, "You cannot lock me into a bond with you, where you become part of my very being and part of what I think, feel, and do every day. I will not bond with you through hatred, anger, or resentment. I will not bond with you through fear. I will not allow you to drag me into your dark world. By forgiving you, I am releasing me, not you. You must live with yourself every day. You must live with the darkness in your heart. But I do not, and I will not." Some of the most tragic lives I have encountered have been those of people who allowed hate, anger, and resentment to consume them, whereas on the inside, behind the brittle layers of pain and hostility, they were truly kind and loving people. David Kelly was such a person. The oldest son of a very harsh and stern father, David had struggled constantly to please, but nothing he ever did was good enough. No matter how long or how hard David worked on their ranch, it was not good enough. No matter how efficiently he handled his responsibilities, no matter how often he volunteered to help beyond those tasks assigned him, he could never win the favor of his father. Not once in David's life did his father ever tell him that he was doing a good job, or that he was a good person. At no time did he ever tell him that he loved him. At no time did he ever touch him physically, unless it was to strike him, push him, or yank him. And no matter what happened, even in his earliest years, David was not allowed to cry. He was not permitted so much as a whimper. He recalled to me the day when, at the age of 7, he had inadvertently leaned against an exhaust stack on a large tractor, severely burning the back of his right arm and shoulder. The burn was such that ultimately David would need hospitalization and a skin graft. Yet standing there before his father, in agony, he was ordered to stop crying. His father mocked him as a baby, a little girl, who ought to be ashamed of his tears. When David could no longer stand it, he fell to his knees, sobbing. His father jerked him to his feet and whipped him with a field rope. Predictably, David learned to be stoic, and he learned to be hard. It became his goal in life to prove to his father that he was a man, that he was strong enough and tough enough for anything. He threw himself into his work, often taking unbelievable chances in the course of the workday, all to impress his father. On an autumn afternoon, not long after David had gotten married, his father was working the fields with a disc plow. When he stopped to find out why the tractor had stalled, it suddenly lurched into gear, pinning him underneath. The plow rolled over him, severing one arm and leaving him to bleed to death, alone in the field. David was absolutely outraged. It frustrated him that his father had gotten himself killed, cheating David out of the chance to prove himself. His hatred, anger, and confusion were all-consuming. When I met David, it was at the behest of his wife, who was concerned about his treatment of their 4-year-old son. She reported that David was treating their child the same way as David's father had treated him. He would not permit the boy to cry, and he would not permit him to be a child. When I was finally able to get David to give a voice to his feelings, he spoke of the rage he felt toward his father for cheating him out of the chance to prove himself and be vindicated. Through tears of frustration and teeth-grinding anger, he said that the SOB had died without ever telling him that he was a man or that he loved him. David professed that he would hate his father until the absolute day that he died for the way he had treated him and for cheating him out of the chance to get even. The ugliness of his emotions left little to the imagination. This was a man racked with pain and bent on self-destruction. It was apparent to me that David had to set himself free. If he did not forgive his father and get emotional closure on his feelings, not only would he continue to pay the price for the rest of his life, but his young son and loving wife would pay as well. As you might guess, I told David everything that I have told you in this program. But in his case, it had to go even beyond that. David had to take action to get emotional closure on his feelings. He felt trapped with no way out because his father's death had deprived him of any chance to make peace. Once he came to understand that his father had him locked in a bond of hatred and resentment,